The Trish Trash Polka, and before that, Perpetual Motion by Johann Strauss II, and before that, The Gallop from Jeu d'Enfant by Bizet. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra was conducted by William Steinberg, and that's from an LP on Command Classics called Curtain Calls. And that's about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. Thank you so much for your company. I do hope you've enjoyed listening. Next week, I have another piano quintet for you. It's by César Franck. My Mozart Symphony choice is number 28 in C major, a concert recording by the London Symphony Orchestra under a much revered Mozartian, Carl Böhm. And Nostalgia provides my musical theme from 10 to 11, which doesn't necessarily mean vintage recordings. For example, there's a new CD that includes a haunting piece called Nostalgia by the Japanese master Toro Takemitsu. I'll be playing that as part of the sequence. So do please join me same time next Sunday, 9 o'clock in the morning. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production here at South Bank Centre today by Neil Miners. Well, it's just gone midday and now it's time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest today is the jeweller Theo Fennell.
There's a huge revival in British craftsmanship going on at the moment, with a new generation keen to learn how to make beautiful things. For 40 years now, Theo Fennell has been one of the country's most distinctive and witty jewellers. His intricate and beautifully crafted designs take you into a strange dream world, miniature skulls with jewelled snakes twisting from their eyes, spiders in silver, bees cast in gold, dragonflies trailing amethysts, salamanders studded with diamonds. Perhaps not surprising that his jewellery has decorated rock stars such as Elton John, Lady Gaga and Freddie Mercury. So a clientele of rock stars, amongst others, Theo Fennell. And I wonder whether you find music inspiring when you are working, dreaming up these strange and beautiful new creatures.
Yes, I do, all the time, and especially when I'm at home and working, where I find I do as much work as anywhere else. I always have music on. And in the studio, obviously, it's a very democratic place, and some of the younger members have some fairly strange stuff on, and they probably think the stuff I have on is pretty strange, but we muddle along and listen to each other's music. And if I have a blank canvas in front of me, if I have a piece of paper that just is saying nothing to me at all, music is, without doubt, my sort of go-to catalyst.
You came out of art school at a time when music and fashion were just exploding, and exploding together in many ways. Kensington in the late 60s, Bieber down the road, Rolling Stones in the air. But a lot of your life has been concentrated on classical music, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think I came out of art school full of every kind of idea of what I might be and what I might not be. And I'd sort of become that person that people discuss at breakfast, what are we going to do with Theo? No sort of fixed idea of what I was going to do at all and no jobs. And I used to hear myself being discussed while I was in the room, you know, and I'd sort of point out that I was there. And my taste in music, which went from the classic to the very camp, from folk music to the most sort of wild thrash music, reflected my taste in other things. I mean, I loved jewellery, I loved painting. I mean, I trained as a portrait painter, discovered I was a very bad one, so I had to find something else to do. And I think, you know, this sort of eclecticism was something that jewellery in the end, it so happened, reflected very well.
I think that composers work with a little cell of notes on the whole. And in fact, we'll hear that at the beginning of your first piece. There's a few notes which become absolutely stuck in the mind. And so I've often thought that music, and especially some of the composers you've had, Fauré, for example, on your list, have a jewel-like quality to them, a jeweller's quality.
I think you're right. Looking at the choice, I think that they're very visual in a way. I mean, that they are, as you say, in many cases, little sketches that are worked on and then become much more defined and bigger. And I think one of the things about jewellery is that you're ending up with a tiny thing into which you've got to pack an awful lot. And I think the same thing with music, and the music I particularly enjoy, is something where the simplicity of it doesn't really reflect the complexity of it, if that makes sense. Mm.
This first piece you played when you were at school, I think.
I did. I bought some records. In those days, they were 30 bob each, but they had a thing called, you know, Music for Pleasure, which were 10 bob, 50p in today's language. And I bought this particular piece as the extra one you could buy, sort of three for a pound. Mm. I'd never heard of Dvorak, and I had no idea what to expect. And I sat down and listened to it when I got back to my room, and I just found it absolutely entrancing.
It's quite a nerve-wracking moment for the soloist, isn't it? Because there's quite a long introduction. And then there's that wonderful moment when the bow first hits the string.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
part of the first movement of Dvořák's Cello Concerto in B minor. Julian Lloyd Webber with the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Václav Neumann. As a child, you were exposed to all kinds of different visual inspirations because your parents travelled a lot, didn't they, through Asia and the Middle East. I think you lived in Egypt and Pakistan.
Yes, I was born in Egypt, funny enough. We then moved to, indeed, to Pakistan, and then in India and France, Germany, and Malaya, indeed. So across the what was then moribund colonies, as it were, a strange time to be there because the British were on the way out. And I think, you know, for people like my father, who lived as a soldier, if you were in the military, you lived a wonderful life abroad. And, of course, you came back to England to find yourself pretty much in the two up, two down without the sort of glories of empire, as it were. But it was incredible to see all those things when I was young, because going to places like the Middle East, where it really was positively biblical, I mean, you know, it hadn't changed for thousands of years, and the modes of transport, the way in which people conducted their lives was so archaic, was quite extraordinary.
Your next choice of music is by Fauré, a quintessential jeweller, to my mind.
The Dolly Suite, strange enough, was the music to a programme called Listen with Mother years and years ago. And for a brief time, when I was quite young, I was at school in England, and in the afternoon, we would have what was known as a ziz, and we'd all have to go into the hall of this sort of strange house that was the sort of, I suppose, what you'd call a kindergarten almost nowadays. And we were given a sort of eiderdown to lie on, and Listen with Mother would come on. And we would indeed listen without mother, in fact, as it happened. And then after that, we would have a ziz. And I remember thinking, and I still, it comes back to me at moments of sort of, you know, of stress, what an extremely agreeable way it was to spend an afternoon.
But the music is very sort of becalming.
It is indeed incredibly pretty. And as you say, very jewel-like. And I always imagine it almost opening a box and this music coming on. Absolutely enchanting. I mean, I think that really is jewel-like. If any music really is jewel-like, that is. And it still makes me think of lying on a floor somewhere in Surrey minding my own business.
Alphonse and Alois Kontarski playing the Berceuse from Fauré's Dolly Suite. When still quite young, Theo Fennell, you played the guitar, didn't you? In fact, I think you actually, when you were an art student, worked as a sort of busker.
Yes, I learned the guitar, as I think almost everybody did, from the Bert Whedon songbook. And I'm always relieved to hear that every great guitarist learnt the same way as I did. And I was never that good, and I'm still learning. And I'm probably the same standard I was when I was 15. But I did indeed have a one-man band, which I bought in a pawn shop. And in those days, pawn shops would have guitars and trumpets and the rather sort of sad detritus of somebody's failed career or a man that had had to sell his livelihood to get through the next couple of days. And I always found it terribly sad. And there, hanging one day in the window, was this one-man band, slightly weird-looking contraption with a sort of bass drum that and leather straps that went across one and cymbals and things. And I learned a little bit. And there was a man around at that time called Don Partridge, who was a very famous busker, and in fact made a couple of records with which he had hits. And my debut as a one-man band was a friend of my mother's asking me to play in front of the Darby and Jones Club in Thirsk for their Christmas party. And I was going to do two songs, and I walked on, sang the first, and as it came to its huge crescendo with cymbals and kazoo and everything, I stopped. There was an echoing silence. And an old man in the front row said, "What were the point of that then?" And that was the only reaction I got. And I tried to walk off because Mrs. Dill, who was running it, was sort of waving a hand to get me off the stage. And trying to walk off a stage in a one-man band in a sort of quiet and dignified way is impossible. So with each roll of my foot, I'd hit my drum and cymbals and disappeared, never to play again.
But you did have a little more success busking in Italian restaurants, didn't you?
I did. I used to get as much as I could drink and as much as I could eat. And no money ever changed hands. But it used to impress the locals. And the great thing about being English in those days, the late 60s, was that you could sing whatever you liked. You could just make it up as you went along. And they assumed you were one of Herman's Hermits or something of the sort. And of course, I never put them right on this.
Well, Offenbach next, the famous barcarolle from his Tales of Hoffmann. Now, I think this has got quite a lot to do with your love of Toulouse-Lautrec.
Yes, I mean, I think towards the end of my teens, I decided I wanted to be a painter, but not particularly any old painter, but an impressionist. And I wanted to be a French impressionist in 1969. It's come sort of 80 years too late, but nonetheless, it seemed to me to hang around in bars and to behave badly with can-can dancers. And it just seemed such an agreeable lifestyle. Of course, I forgot about having no legs or very short legs and about living in a garret and having no money at all. But the whole idea of France and the sort of Belle Époque and the fin de siècle was just such a terrifically attractive one. And the music that obviously went with that was Offenbach and this wonderful little duet.
Fin du siècle Paris and A Night of Love, where even the wind carries kisses and caresses.
Yes. In fact, it ended up in York with no kisses or caresses, but nonetheless, one must aspire to something.
Thank you.
What fantastic voices. Really quite extraordinary.
The Barcarolle from Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffmann. We heard Joan Sutherland and Huguette Tourangeau with the orchestra of the Swiss Romande, conducted by Richard Bonning. In fact, actually, she wouldn't sing without him, which caused one or two complications for opera houses, but you can understand if they had a very close working relationship.
Indeed. And I think a very terrifying woman.
We're still in Paris, or a.k.a. York, for the next music, which is a classic French love song. And I think it's your father that this reminds you of.
Yes, my father was a man of his time. He was that strange sort of combination of romanticism and pragmatism that so many Englishmen of his generation were. The sort of soldier poet, but also an extremely funny man and a badly behaved man. And he, I think, rather as I felt about fin de siècle Paris, he felt about 30s Paris. He'd spent time there in the 30s, and he was besotted by what he saw out there and what he heard out there. And at home, we would have these sort of dinner parties, and afterwards he would put on, it was always known as the French hour. So after we sat down, everybody had enough to drink, he would put on various songs, always French songs of the 30s and 40s. And the one that stands out a mile because he loved it and it brought a tear to his eye and now to mine was Vous qui passez sans me voir. I absolutely love it and still do.
What's it about?
It's about a woman that walks past a man and doesn't look at him. I mean, we get to a certain age and we know just how Jean Sablon feels.
Jean Sablon singing Vous qui passez sans me voir. That's really a song, I suppose, of erotic yearning. You believe that Julie has a very strong erotic part. And when you opened your first shop, you had a rather marvellous experience, which taught you quite a bit, I think, about the lure, the allure of jewellery.
Oh, yes, yes. In those days, there were no credit cards, only cheques and things like that. And it was Friday afternoon was a key time, A, because the more we'd made our money by Friday, the earlier we could close and go to lunch and never come back. But Friday was the key day as to how much money we had to pay each other. And it really was as basic as that. And just before we closed, an enormous car rolled up outside the shop, and a brutish little man got out. Terrible-looking man got out with the leggiest, most beautiful blonde you've ever seen in your life and came to the door. And we were slightly surprised because we didn't get many Rolls-Royces in those days. And in they came, and he said, I'd like to buy something for the young lady. And so we said, fine. And they started looking at things. She started trying things on. He sat around being brutish and really quite unpleasant to this girl. But you know, she carried on and she tried things on. And eventually he said, you've got anything bigger? And we had a necklace, it so happened, that we thought we'd never sell. It was in the safe, but the most expensive thing we had. And we bought it up. She tried it on. She beamed. He said, do you like it? And she said, I love it. And he said, you can have it then. Friday afternoon, he said, I'd like to pay for it. And we said, well, I'm terribly sorry, but the banks are closed, whatever. Anyway, so he left us a cheque. And he said, I'll be back on Monday morning, he said, or Tuesday to pick it up. Or would it be better if I came back on Monday with the cash? So we said Monday with the cash would be terrific. Anyway, he left. We celebrated. We had a weekend of wild celebration on the back of this sale. And on Monday morning at 10 o'clock, there he was, the Rolls-Royce, on his own. And he came in and we said, everything all right? He said, oh, everything is all right, he said. And we said, you know, we haven't had time to clear the cheque or anything. Have you bought the cash? And he said, no, let me have a look at the cheque, please. We gave him the cheque. And he tore it up and he said, thanks for a great weekend.
So he was an out-and-out con man?
Yes, a rotter and a charlatan.
He probably went round London doing this.
Yes, he probably did. Although I feel that I was the one that was conned, and I've never felt really good about it since.
I can imagine. Well, let's soothe you with some more music. I think the next music you like to hear when you're drawing in a sketchbook.
Yes, it's a, fun enough, it's a, because of that, there's a sketch I did actually in this book I have here that was done while listening to this. Was a picture of the chair that I normally sit in when I'm on holiday to draw. And so it was a sort of drawing of a drawing of a drawing of a person drawing. And I think this piece has that sort of strange introspective quality. Thank you.
part of the first movement of the Saint-Saëns Violin Concerto No. 3 in B minor. Yehudi Menuhin, the soloist with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Gaston Poulet. While we were listening to that, music of such elegance, Theo Fennell, you were showing me this sketchbook that you often draw in when you're listening to the music. And I must say, I couldn't believe it, because it looks to me like a printed album. It's so beautifully laid out, so neat. Drawings of your daughters, drawings of yourself, as you said, and sketches of jewellery. It's really beautiful. Perhaps if you'd let us put a few of them on our website, people could sample them.
Yes, of course. I mean, I think it's a sort of aide-memoire of ideas and thoughts and whatever. I don't carry a camera with me, so I draw rather than take photographs. And the bizarre thing is that it's no different, I don't suppose, from somebody fiddling around on the piano or writing little notes down for a novel. It's really the sort of assimilation of lots of ideas and influences. And wherever I am, I like to draw it, so I find it very cathartic. And it is, it's that sort of tinkling the ivories and hoping that something manifests.
Yes, but they're beautifully organised. They're kind of framed. They're not just left like some improvisations or some sketches sort of dangling over the page. They're very finished things in a way.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing that years ago somebody said to me, if you draw in black ink, you have to commit yourself. And I'd been drawing in pencil for years and then rubbing it out and sort of making things into much more finished pieces, if you like. And the great thing about black ink is it taught me over the years to commit to it and to finish it and just carry on. And I couldn't quite bear to have things that were sort of quite so uncharted as that. And so I found myself doing little frames and doing them within that. And I think it's something, probably some deep-rooted problem I have that will come out, manifest itself when I finally murder somebody. Or something that makes me want to have things quite so organised on paper. And I think if you are designing jewellery, it's such a tiny world you're working in that you do need to contain it.
You've made jewellery for many musicians, and in particular Elton John.
For somebody like me, when I was young, I was a huge Elton John fan, and I listened to his music. The first album was one of those ones that, you know, in the garret that spoke to one and all that sort of stuff. And funnily enough, my wife adored the album from which the next song comes, as indeed did I. And both my daughters found it their favourite song when they came to him later on. And he was an extraordinary person to meet, because I was lucky enough to meet a few musicians early on who became patrons.
Tickets I've forgotten.
Elton John's Tiny Dancer from the 1971 Madman Across the Water album. It's brilliant the way he keeps you waiting for that chorus, but when it comes, it's wonderful.
Yes, he's funny. It's much cleverer than it first sounds. I think the art of writing good pop music is much more complicated than people think. I think people have tried to sit down and say, well, it can't be that difficult. You know, we're talking about three chords. We're talking about, you know, a very gentle and simple structure, but it really isn't that easy.
Prokofiev next, his Symphony No. 5 in B-flat, and I think it's the slow movement you've asked for, which is very powerful.
Yeah, I think the funny thing about this is that I became sort of obsessed with the Great War when I was quite young, and even though this was written in the Second War, the mood of it is much more sort of plangent and muddy, and it's much more the Somme. I mean, I see Passchendaele and I see all those terrible things to this. And I think the way, you know, where he was when it was written, the whole way in which it happened, when he was sort of away from everything and yet inches away from where this terrible sort of tragedy was playing out in Russia in the end of the war, allowed to be in this colony and, you know, do his stuff. I just find it an absolutely amazing piece of work.
It's very dark material, isn't it?
Very dark. I think there's something very life-enhancing about it as well. I think you know somehow that it's all going to come through and come good. And I do, as I say, I always see the Great War rather than the Second World War to that.
Music from the third movement of Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony. We heard Simon Rattle conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. I said at the opening that there was a revival in British craftsmanship happening at the moment. And are you aware of this?
Yes, I'm actually very involved with a lot of young craftsmen, and we have apprentices in the workshop who really live in the same way that apprentices did 500 years ago. We beat them frequently and put them under the desk at night. No, but it changes their lives. And I think there's a huge revival now in doing things with your hands. You know, the god of mammon isn't quite as prevalent as he was. And there are so many more people now wanting to become craftsmen, and much easier to find young apprentices than it used to be.
Talking of craftsmanship, you've been sketching while we've been talking. And I love people to see some of the other drawings you've done. And if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website and look for the word gallery, you'll be able to home in on some of Theo Fennell's pictures. You love musicals, so we're going to end with one of your favourite songs from one of your favourite musicals, The King and I. You've chosen the song Something Wonderful.
I've chosen Something Wonderful because it's really, I think, there to epitomise all the songs that make me blub in musicals. And I think I can't really ever love somebody, male or female, who doesn't blub in a musical from time to time. And I think Rodgers and Hammerstein hit it on the head. It was a toss-up between this and I Don't Know How to Love Him, which I think my wife would have chosen. Now I think about it, for more reasons than one.
And do you identify with these lyrics? This is a man who thinks with his heart. His heart is not always wise. This is a man who stumbles and falls. But this is a man who tries.
Do you know I do?
Theo Fennell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a man who thinks with his heart. His heart is not always wise. This is a man who stumbles and falls, but this is a man who tries. This is a man you'll forgive and forgive and help and protect as long as you live. He will not always say what you would have him say,
Terry Saunders singing Rodgers and Hammerstein's Something Wonderful from the 1956 film The King and I, ending this week's edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest was the jeweller Theo Fennell, and the programme was produced by Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. You may like to know that you can download that programme and many more by going to the Private Passions page on the BBC Radio 3 website. And next week, at the same time, Michael Barclay will be in conversation with the author Adam Nicholson. Hello, I'm John Shea on the last full day of Radio 3's South Bank residency. It's a warm, sunny day here beside the Thames. And before we pack up our studio today, there are live editions of the early music show at 2 o'clock this afternoon and the choir at 4 o'clock. Now, though, it's just after 1 o'clock. Let's return briefly to Broadcasting House for the news read by David Cornett.
About 30 relatives of Chinese passengers who were on the missing Malaysian passenger jet have arrived in Kuala Lumpur to demand answers from the authorities. They unfurled a banner saying they wanted evidence about what had happened to the plane. The international search for the airliner is being stepped up, with 10 aircraft and 8 ships deployed in the southern Indian Ocean. A black box detector capable of picking up a signal from nearly 4 miles below the water's surface has been loaded onto an Australian ship in Perth. It'll head out to sea tomorrow. The crisis in Ukraine will be discussed by the US Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov when they meet in Paris this afternoon. Moscow has insisted that it has no plans to invade eastern Ukraine, but Washington remains sceptical. Newspaper allegations made by a prostitute have prompted the Conservative MP Mark Minges to resign as a ministerial aide. The Sunday Mirror reports that the Brazilian man claims Mr. Minges paid him for sex and asked him to buy an illegal drug. Mr. Minges, who's 42, said a number of the allegations were not true. The government has dismissed criticism of reductions to spending on defence. In an interview with the Sunday Times, General Sir Richard Sheriff said Britain's armed forces have been cut to the bone. But the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, said much of the criticism of the government's plans was nonsense. Labour's election coordinator, Douglas Alexander, says the party will set out changes to university tuition fees in England in its general election manifesto. It's reported that Labour is considering reducing the maximum limit for tuition fees from £9,000 a year to £6,000. French voters are taking part in local elections. Opposition parties, including the National Front, are expected to make gains. And the weather this afternoon should be mostly dry and warm in England and Wales, with plenty of hazy sunshine. It'll be cooler and cloudier further north. Temperatures will peak at around 19 Celsius in London, 17 in Cardiff and Manchester, 12 in Belfast, but only 6 in Edinburgh. BBC News and weather at 1:03.
Thank you, David Cornett. So, Lucy Skeeping is here at 2 o'clock this afternoon with a live edition of the Early Music Show. And before that, time now for today's lunchtime concert. And this afternoon, another chance to hear a recital that the American pianist Nicholas Angelich gave last year at LSO St Luke's. He'll be playing Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition in just under 20 minutes from now, after a piece that perhaps we ought to hear unannounced. At any rate, that's how the audience at the Independent Musical Society in Paris first heard it in 1911 as part of a Guess the Composer evening. Well, I'll spare you that. The composer is Ravel, and the piece is his Valse Noble et Sentimentale.